he wouldn't be able to repay all of his customers at the same time. She gritted her teeth. The Bank of Silence wasn't the flashiest innovation she'd introduced, but it might well do more good than anything else in the long term. Merely giving people a safe space to store their money made life better, while microloans ensured that innovators had the backing they needed to turn their ideas into reality. The thought of it crashing down in ruins through someone else's financial mismanagement was appalling. And yet, if hundreds of customers demanded their money back, how could anyone say no? This could break the bank, she breathed. It's a possibility. Marcus looked down at the wooden floor. I'm very glad that Melissa is safely in Whitehall. Emily swallowed. She might be safe. She was on better terms with Melissa these days, but she still didn't like her very much. But what about you? I don't know, Marcus said. Emily, this could destroy your fortune as well. I know, Emily said, and I have no way to move the money out before it's too late. She cursed under her breath. In hindsight, she might just have outsmarted herself. She'd put half of her fortune into the Bank of Silence, both to give Marcus some seed money and to keep it safe from King Randor's grasping hands. But now, she couldn't even move it back to Cockatrice. The mere hint that someone was moving their money out of the bank might start everything rolling downhill to disaster. And she had no way to guess at just how big the disaster was likely to be. You could buy up the notes, Marcus said. That might limit the scale of the crash. Emily shook her head. There were just too many notes. Even if she bought them at their original value, she'd still run out of money fairly quickly. And the bank would have the same problem. Perhaps if all Vesperian needed was 10,000 crowns, something could be done. But if he needed more... He wouldn't have asked for so much if he wasn't desperate, she thought grimly. And perhaps he has good reason to be desperate. The investors would want full price, she said. They wouldn't take less than that until it was too late. And the notes became worthless paper, Marcus said. He rubbed his eyes. I'm going to call an emergency meeting of the Bankers Guild. If we discuss the matter in a body, we can approach Vesperian and demand he shows us the books. I've got accountants who can go through every last scrap of paper and pull together a complete picture of his affairs. Frida leaned forward. And what if he refuses to cooperate? We can advise people not to buy any further notes, Marcus said. Beyond that, there isn't much we can do. There's no financial authority to regulate transactions, Emily thought numbly. And no international police force to track Vesperian down if he grabs everything he can carry and runs. You could always put in a demand for repayment, Emily pointed out. Couldn't you threaten to seize the railway? The Guild Council would have to approve it, Marcus said. And Vesperian has a lot of allies amongst the guildsmen. They bought his notes, Frida said. And he's been creating jobs, Marcus added. The Ironworkers Guild loves him. So do most of the woodworkers. The guildmasters would hesitate to take firm steps against him until the disaster was obvious. And then it would be too late, Emily said. She frowned, thinking hard. Vesperian had definitely overreached himself, that much was certain. But had someone else backed him? Had someone offered to pick up the tab, then defaulted? Who would benefit? King Randor was the most likely suspect, but the economic shockwaves would wash over Zangaria, too. Alessa's father had grown increasingly paranoid over the last couple of years, but he wasn't stupid. He'd know better. Wouldn't he? Or was she overthinking it? It wasn't as if any outside player was necessary. Vesperian might have created the disaster without any outside help at all, and then... She met Marcus's eyes. Who's the richest person in the city? Marcus smiled. The richest person that I know about is you. Frida giggled. If one believes rumors, Marcus continued, Vesperian and Grand Guildmaster Jaleel are worth thousands of crowns apiece. Below them, there's a boatload of other wealthy men. Why? Emily looked down at her hands. If I was feeling cunning, she said, I'd wait until the crash came. Then buy up everything Vesperian has for a song. The railway and its rolling stock would be mine. I'd cut back on the planned expansion and concentrate on milking everything I could out of the existing infrastructure. And possibly do more expansion later, Marcus said, once you had everything on solid ground again. He made a face. Do you think someone is waiting to do just that? Emily shrugged. We can't be the only ones who see impending trouble, she mused, and who knows what Vesperian will do if he is truly desperate. It could take years to unravel the mess, Marcus said. Emily, do you want to attend the meeting? You are a major shareholder in the bank. I think the bankers would prefer to deal with you, Emily said. She didn't enjoy big meetings. Working with people one-on-one was much less stressful. And I have to discuss the matter with others. You might need to mention it to King Randor, Marcus said. You are one of his aristocrats, even if you're technically in exile. He probably needs to be warned. And Emeka, Emily said. She could send a letter to Randor. It would give him time to think before he wrote a reply. Cockatrice is right next door. Close enough for trouble to spill over. Marcus stood and paced over to the window. I wonder if any of us will have a pot to piss in when all of this is over. I wish I knew. Emily finished her drink, then rose. Frida followed her. Be careful, all right?
You too.
Marcus turned to face her. And if anyone asks about those rumors, what should I say? Emily made a face. On one hand, the thought of allowing Vesperian to keep spreading lies was unappealing. If, of course, it was Vesperian spreading lies. But on the other hand, an outright denial might make matters worse. Anyone who thought the railway was about to collapse, dragging half the city down with it, would do everything in their power to get their money out before it was too late. And in doing so, they'd start the collapse. Tell the general public that you're not allowed to comment, she said slowly. It was true enough. The Bank of Silence prided itself on not sharing information with anyone. And tell the bankers that I won't be putting any money into the railway. As you wish, Marcus said. He glanced back out the window. Do you want to use the tunnel to leave? I think we'd better, Emily said. I don't want to be noticed. That might be too late, Marcus said. But try and stay out of sight as much as possible. Emily cast a glamour over herself as she followed the secretary down a long staircase and into a servants' corridor. The air hummed with powerful wards, blurring together into a sensation that made her head spin. It was a relief when they stepped into the tunnel, cast a set of light globes, and walked under the road. The wards faded as they hurried away from the bank.
It feels surreal, Frida said.
Emily glanced back at her. Pardon? Frida looked as if she didn't quite believe herself.
I thought I knew threats, she said softly. My father approaching me with a belt was a personal threat. A blight on the crops or a harder frost was a threat to the whole village. I've had people threaten me with beatings or hexes or the walls trying to crush us. That's a threat, too.
She glanced up at the low ceiling.
But this threat is so strange, so hard to see. There's no foreign army at the gates, no fires threatening to burn down the entire city, just pieces of paper. It's insubstantial. There's no sense of threat. And yet you're saying it could bring down everything.
The fires will come, Emily predicted, once the truth gets out.
It feels like nothing, Frida said.
Emily understood exactly how she felt. Caleb and his family had grown up with money, even if it had been the rough gold and silver coins of the nameless world rather than a standardized currency. Frida had probably never touched money until she'd been sold to Mountaintop, perhaps not even until Emily had given her money in Cockatrice. She'd grown up in a world of barter, where a blacksmith or a cobbler might trade their work for food, and families pooled their resources just to stay alive. To her, the growing crisis was so nebulous that it might not even exist. Look at it this way, she said. Pretend you have 10 crowns in your money pouch.
I wish, Frida said.
Emily snorted. You loan me those 10 crowns, after I promise to repay you 15, she said. Vesperian had offered her such terms, after all. But I can't repay you. What do you do? Frida shrugged.
Take it out of your hide?
You could, Emily agreed. It was precisely what Frida's family would have done. But in the meantime, your bills come due. You have to pay 10 crowns yourself to your creditors, And you can't pay them because you gave me the money. There's a limit to what you can get out of my hide. Perhaps I don't own my house or tools. Perhaps I don't own anything. Or maybe I abandon ship and run before you can start tearing me to pieces. What do you do then?
My creditors try to take it out of my hide, Frida said.
Precisely, Emily said. Do you own a house? They'll take the house. Or whatever you have. That's the threat. It isn't just about large sums of money evaporating into thin air. It's about what happens when that money is never repaid. They reached the end of the tunnel and made their way through a set of complex wards and into the house. Emily had expected someone to meet them at the far end, but the house looked deserted. They walked to the door and opened it, recoiling in shock at the sudden noise. A small procession was making its way through the streets, chanting a single word over and over again. "Justice! Justice! Justice!" Emily fought the urge to cover her ears as the procession marched past the door. It was led by the Hands of Justice, but hundreds of others from all walks of life had joined the chanting parade. A set of grim-faced stewards ran from place to place, pushing and shoving marchers in and out of line. A handful of young girls in flowing white dresses handed out pamphlets to interested onlookers. Emily took one absently and scanned it, noting the claim that justice had killed hundreds of sinners. It was long on gruesome detail and short on accurate fact. This can't be true, she thought. We'd be seeing statues everywhere if hundreds of people had been killed. She folded up the pamphlet and pocketed it, then hurried down the street. It was barely mid-afternoon, but crowds were already forming everywhere. There was an ugly note in the air, something she remembered from Farrakhan. The city was on edge again. She hoped they could get back to Caleb's house before something happened. It felt as though they were standing on a powder keg. We are, she thought. There was another batch of letters waiting for her when they reached Caleb's house. Sienna passed them to her without comment, muttering something about impudent correspondence when she turned away. Emily looked past her, hoping to see Caleb, but there was no sign of him. Karen was the only one in sight, sitting on a sofa, darning her socks. Emily sat on the chair and glanced through the letters. They were all the same, inviting her to dinner with vague promises that it would be made worth her while. Sighing, she started to write out another set of polite but firm rejections while Frida read her book and made notes for her fourth-year project. Emily envied her. She didn't have to worry about banking problems and financial disasters. "Dinner time," Sienna called. "Come now if you're coming." There was no sign of General Pollock, Caleb, or Marion at the table. Conversation was stilted. Sienna seemed occupied with some greater thought, while Karen and Croce kept throwing odd glances at Emily. Emily felt uncomfortable, wishing she could speed up time in order to escape. She'd never known what to say at the dinner table. A messenger arrived midway through the meal, carrying a note from Marcus. "Vesperian refuses to talk," it read. "Now what?" Chapter 14.
"Wake up," Frida said. "Emily?"
Emily opened her eyes.
What time is it?"
"Time to get up," Frida prompted quietly. "You have to get dressed."
Emily nodded as she sat upright and stood. Sienna had taken one look at her when she'd come down for breakfast, deduced that Emily hadn't slept well at all, and ordered her back to bed after a light snack. Emily had been too tired and restless to argue, but when she'd returned to her bed, she hadn't been able to sleep. She'd been too busy trying to figure out a way to defuse a ticking time bomb. And yet she must have slept. Her watch insisted that it was after midday. She stumbled into the bathroom, removed her nightgown, and splashed water on her face. It didn't help. The face she saw in the mirror looked pale enough to pass for a vampire, with dark circles around her eyes. She rubbed her eyes in annoyance, then stepped under the shower. She'd been told, in no uncertain terms, that she wasn't to use a glamour or anything else to alter her appearance during the funeral. It was, apparently, tradition.
"Hurry," Frida called. "We'll be leaving in 30 minutes.
"I know." Emily stepped out of the shower and looked at herself critically. The cuts and bruises were fading, thankfully, but she still felt tired.
I'm coming.
Frida pushed past her into the shower as Emily entered the bedroom. The morning clothes were already waiting for them, hanging behind the door. Emily pulled on an undershirt, then took the larger of the two black robes from the hook and pulled it over her head. It was shapeless as the robe she wore at Whitehall. Karen and Marion had spent the last 2 days sewing them for the funeral. It looked simple, yet there were a handful of complex designs stitched into the cloth. They weren't magic, as far as she could tell. She had no idea what they meant. She tied her hair back, then inspected herself in the mirror. There was no sign that she was wearing anything underneath her robe, thankfully. Emeka had joked about wearing her robes and nothing else at school, but Emily knew she couldn't do the same. Someone might just try to levitate her and flip her over. They'd get in awful trouble, she knew, yet it might not be enough to deter some of the boys, or even some of the girls.
"You look like a ghost," Frida said, coming back into the bedroom. "It isn't going to be that bad."
"I feel like a ghost," Emily muttered. "I'll get better."
Frida dressed quickly, then tied her hair into a pair of pigtails.
"How do I look?"
Emily examined her critically. "Ready to go?" she said, grabbing her shoes. "Shall we?" She could hear the bell tolling as she walked down the stairs and into the living room. Sienna, Karen, and Marion waited for her, all wearing the same black robes. Sienna's face was hidden behind a black veil that made her look sinister, while both of Casper's sisters were bareheaded. They'd left their hair completely untied.
"Very good," Sienna said, after a quick inspection. "Come."
The bell tolled louder as they made their way to the door. It hung above the porch, sounding again and again. Emily resisted the urge to cover her ears as she walked underneath the bell. No one was touching it, she saw. Sienna must have charmed the bell to sound constantly. Outside, a small crowd had already gathered. They were a diverse collection. Guildmasters, priests, sorcerers, and even commoners. Most of them wore black, although only a handful wore formal robes. The coffin itself stood at the center of the road, with General Pollock, Caleb, and Croce standing behind it. Emily tried to catch Caleb's eye, but he was staring at the coffin. Perhaps he hadn't really grasped that his brother was dead until the funeral had begun. Sienna stepped forward. Silence fell.
"My son fell in battle," she said. Her voice echoed on the air. "Today we lay him to rest."
She lifted a hand, pointing at the coffin. Emily felt the spell a moment before the coffin rose into the air, then started to glide down the street. Frida pulled her into position beside the coffin as they walked beside, Sienna and her husband taking the lead. The streets were lined with people, all present to bid Casper farewell. Emily couldn't help wondering how many of them were there because they'd known Casper, and how many of them had come just to be seen. Whatever he'd been in life, in death, Casper had become the city's favorite son. The crowd was silent as the coffin went past them. Emily couldn't hear anything, even a cough. She reached out with her senses, picking up the edges of a powerful silencing spell. It was an impressive piece of work, blanketing the coffin and surrounding crowds. She wasn't sure she could have cast anything like it herself. Sienna was a very skilled magician. No wonder Casper was so determined to prove himself, she thought. He wanted to impress both of his parents. She glanced at Caleb. His head was bowed. What little she could see of his face was somber. Casper had been his brother, for better or worse. She knew the two boys hadn't been close, but still, they were family. No, they'd been family. They wouldn't see each other again. Unless, of course, there really was life after death. The Temple of War rose up in front of them, standing amidst the other temples. It was a massive building, made from white stone and covered in hundreds of statues. There were men, all men, holding weapons, ranging from clubs and swords to crossbows and even muskets. The latter statues looked new, she thought. They would have to be. There hadn't been any guns on the Nameless World until she'd introduced them. She followed the coffin into the temple, careful to keep an eye on Karen. When the younger girl stepped to the side, Emily walked after her. Frida moved up beside her, touching Emily's hand lightly, as Caleb walked to the other side. General Pollock and Sienna followed the coffin into the exact center of the building, moving to each side as the coffin drifted down onto a stone altar. Emily glanced around, taking in the decorations. The interior of the temple was covered in carvings, each one showing a single man standing against overwhelming odds. Most showed humans or orcs as the enemy, but one showed a single amorphous creature, and another showed no enemy at all. And yet the old script written around the carving suggested there should be something there. Silence fell. A single man, wearing a golden suit of armor, clanked his way to the coffin and turned to face the crowd. He was the priest, she realized. Every square inch of him was covered in armor, save for his dark face. His voice, when he spoke, was so full of gravitas that Emily found herself paying close attention. There was no magic in his words, merely presence.
"A man who goes to war goes to prove himself," he rumbled. "He may stand firm against the enemies of all, or he may break and run. He may prove himself a man, or he may run like a woman. War proves him."
Emily concealed her amusement. She didn't know anyone who would dare suggest Lady Barb or Sienna hadn't proven themselves in war. Hell, she'd been in the war, too. But she understood what the priest meant. Sergeant Harkin had said much the same when she'd been pushed into his class. War was the ultimate expression of masculinity, he'd said. A woman who wanted to succeed had to act like a man. And there are very few female non-magicians who fight in wars, she recalled. Lady Barb had made no bones about that, either. Even a trained woman can be dangerously outmatched if she meets a skilled opponent.
"Caspar of House Waterfall went to war," the priest continued. "And while he fell in battle. He fell in honorable combat. He did not run. He did not hide. He stood up to the enemy and died in glorious battle."
Emily shivered, fighting down a flicker of anger. It hadn't been glorious. She'd had half a plan. A plan that had threatened to go off the rails even before they'd discovered the necromancer's secret. She knew she'd been scared when she walked into Heart's Eye. Caspar, she was sure, had felt scared too. "Feeling fear isn't the problem," she recalled. "The problem lies in allowing your fear to dominate you."
"For those who fall in battle, death is not the end," the priest said. "They rise to the heights of war to serve the gods in their battles with evil. They will feast in the halls of war, then go out to fight, and then return, brothers in arms with the gods themselves. We honor their memory just as we look forward to joining them."
Emily kept her face expressionless. The prospect of spending eternity feasting and fighting didn't appeal to her, although she could see why some people might like it. A godly realm might turn war into a game, rather than a life-or-death challenge. The slain might rise again to feast and fight after they fell in heavenly war. But it didn't strike her as restful. It wasn't what she wanted. And it might be a lie told to encourage the troops, the cynical side of her mind noted sarcastically. Why fear death if it is merely the gateway to eternal reward?
"Caspar died, and died well."
The priest held up one hand in a rough salute.
"And we deem him worthy to pass through the iron gates and take his place among the elect."
There was a long pause. Emily risked another look at Caleb. He was watching the coffin with grim eyes. General Pollock was completely expressionless, even as he stepped forward and drew his sword. The blade shone so brightly that she was sure it had been charmed.
"From birth, life is a risk," General Pollock said.
His face was as immobile as granite.
"Parents swiftly come to learn that they cannot shield their child from danger, that they cannot protect them against the world, that even trying can do terrifying damage. It is never easy to strike the balance between supporting one's children and letting them make their own mistakes, between being there to help them and allowing them to deal with the consequences of their ignorance. Parenting is not easy. My son chose to follow his father into the military. I was proud of him, even as I feared for his life. Casper was my firstborn son, the fruit of my loins. I did not want to lose him. I wanted him to remain safe and well. And yet I could not stand in his way. A youngster has to make his own mistakes before his parents die, before he stands alone against a hostile world. He thought I knew nothing, of course. Such is the folly of youth.
He paused. Emily kept her thoughts to herself. If Casper's father had told him that before he died...
It is tragic when a father outlives his son, General Pollock said. I believed there would come a time when Casper carried the torch to my coffin and lit the fire. Instead, I must watch as my son's coffin burns. I mourn for his loss. And yet I am proud of my son. Like me, when I was young, he wanted to prove himself. Like me, he chose war as his way to prove himself. He sought out a challenge, then another challenge. When the time came, he did not flinch. He was no coward. His death did not shame him or any of us.
There was a second pause. This time it seemed to last forever.
It is never easy to know how one will react when one faces the challenge.
General Pollock held up his sword and considered it reflectively, then returned the blade to his belt.
It is not something you learn until you actually do it. And then you find out what you actually are. My son could have hurried back to the army. It would have been easy for him to justify a tactical retreat on the grounds that someone had to take a warning to the city before it was too late, but he didn't. When the time came, when he was tested, my son proved himself worthy of his heritage. And so I am proud, even as I mourn his loss.
He stepped back smartly. Emily found herself blinking away tears as Sienna moved forward, her gaze sweeping the hall. General Pollock hadn't been that good a father to his oldest son, she knew. Casper had been trapped between his father's expectations and his father's legacy. He'd even been on the verge of suicide before he'd finally had a chance to prove himself. And yet, the general truly mourned his son. Casper had grown up, but there had been no time to mend their relationship. We bring our children into the world. Sienna's voice was so composed that Emily knew she was in distress. We birth them. We bathe them. We teach them their lessons and show them how to behave. And we watch helplessly as infants grow into children and children grow into adults, pushing gently against us all the time. There always comes a time when the cord must snap. When the newborn adult must stand on his own, when... I have seen war. I have seen skirmishes and clashes. I have campaigned against the necromancers and hunted rogue sorcerers until only one of us emerged victorious. When Casper came to me to ask for my blessing, I knew I would sooner go back to war myself than let him go. In my mind, he was still the little boy I'd raised from birth. I did not want him to die. But I looked him in the eye, she added. I told him to make me proud. I told him to live up to the legacy of both sides of the family. And I hated myself for saying it because I knew that war kills. I have lost friends and family in battles, some killed outright while others were never the same afterwards. I knew my son could die. I let him go. I could not have stopped him. How could I? He was a grown man, as little as I might care to admit it. He would have resented me if I'd stopped him from going, even, perhaps, hated me. I've seen lives ruined because they wouldn't go to war, because they were mocked and belittled until harsh words became a cancer gnawing at their souls. Casper wanted to go, and I could not stop him. I had to let him go. I will never see my little boy again, she finished. But I am proud of the man he became. Emily had to wipe away her tears as Sienna stepped back.
The priest turned to face the coffin, chanting in a language she didn't recognize. General Pollock waited until the priest finished, then drew his sword again and placed it on the coffin. A moment later, he bowed and strode out of the temple. Caleb and Croce followed him, bowing to the coffin before heading for the rear door. The remainder of the men followed them. Sienna waited until the last of the men had bowed, before leading the women past the coffin and out into the rear garden. "I'm sorry," Emily thought as she looked at the coffin. "The empty coffin. I wish I could have brought your body home." Frida slipped her hand into Emily's as they walked out into the garden. It was strange. A handful of plants had grown up around dozens of statues. A handful of men in silver uniforms milled around, carrying trays of drinks. Emily took one and sniffed it carefully. She was no expert, but she thought there was enough alcohol in the earthen bowl to make a strong man drunk. Hopefully no one would notice, or care, if she didn't drink. The wake was a strange affair. Some of the mourners were clearly grieving. Others were drinking beer as though there were no tomorrow, laughing and dancing as the sun started to fall towards the horizon. She was torn between revulsion and a kind of rueful understanding that the celebration did make sense. Caspar might be dead, but he'd died well. And he'd gone on to Valhalla. Or something along the same lines, she thought, fighting and feasting for all eternity. She watched Caleb as yet another stranger walked up to him to express his condolences, and perhaps to open up discussions. Caleb was the heir now, even if he hadn't been formally confirmed. Emily couldn't help thinking that her boyfriend looked stressed, perhaps even on the verge of collapse. His hands shook as they held a glass. She had no idea how much he'd drunk, but it could easily be far too much. Some of the younger men were having a drinking contest, and then she sensed the presence of something. She looked up as the crowd scattered, the magically sensitive reaching for spells or ducking for cover. A man stood on top of the nearest building, a tower that was easily one of the tallest buildings on Temple Row. He was right on the edge, staring down at the crowd. And there was something billowing around him, a haze that touched her senses and scrambled them. Something was very wrong. "Vesperian," someone breathed. And then the man jumped. Chapter 15. Someone screamed. Emily barely heard it as she tried desperately to muster a levitation spell. It should be simplicity itself to catch Vesperian before he hit the ground and smashed himself into a pancake. She wasn't the only sorcerer trying, either. Magic boiled around the crowd, reaching towards the falling man. And breaking up, fading into nothingness. She blinked in astonishment. It felt almost as though someone had wrapped a basic protective ward around Vesperian. But it was wrong. She tried again, tightening her spell. There were so many spells trying to catch Vesperian that one of them, at least, should have worked. No protective ward should have been able to break up so many spells. And yet Vesperian kept falling. He hit the ground with a terrible thud. "Justice," someone breathed. Emily looked up, but the rooftop was empty. She heard the sounds of panic behind her and turned, yanking Frida towards Caleb and his family as the crowd started to go wild. The priest shouted for order, but his words fell on deaf ears. Emily heard someone screaming that Vesperian owed him money before the words were lost behind an incoherent sound. Outside, she heard chanting. The hands of justice were on the way. Sienna cast an amplification spell. "Remain calm," she ordered. Her words had little effect. Several of the younger men were already fighting each other, although Emily had no idea why. Others tried to climb over the walls or flee back into the temple, as if they thought it would be safe. "Remain calm!" General Pollock shot Emily a relieved look as she reached them. "This isn't good," he said stiffly. "We have to get back home." Emily nodded. A team of city guardsmen had already arrived, pushing their way into the garden, but they looked edgy. There were sorcerers in the panicking crowd, sorcerers who might blast the guardsmen at any moment. Their commander hurried his men to the body of Vesperian and surrounded it, although Emily didn't have the slightest idea what he thought he was doing.
Somehow, keeping the crime scene free of contaminants seemed pointless.
"It's him," the commander called. "Vesperian is dead."
"Idiot," Sienna swore. The sound of chanting grew louder, seemingly coming from all directions. Emily glanced around, trying to determine the safest way out of the temple. She reached for her magic, preparing to teleport them home, but stopped herself abruptly. If something had kept a crowd of magic users from saving a falling man, what would it do if she tried to teleport?
"Justice."
Marion sounded dazed.
"I saw justice."
"Be quiet," Sienna snapped.
"We have to move," General Pollock said.
His voice boomed over the crowd.
"I'll take the lead. Caleb, you and Croce bring up the rear. Don't hesitate to use magic to clear the way if necessary."
Emily swallowed hard as they hurried towards the gate. Men and women swarmed the streets, fleeing in all directions. Groups of worshippers fought, pouring out of their temples and into the fray. The hands of justice seemed to be stalled, but they fought with a discipline that surprised her. She hadn't seen so much discipline from the foot soldiers she'd watched during the war. The remainder of the city guard was nowhere to be seen.
"They'll be setting up wards along Sorcerer's Row," Sienna called back. "Let me go first when we reach the entrance."
"Of course, dear."
General Pollock sounded pained.
"But we have to get out of here first."
Emily felt her body shake as they made their way down the street. The sheer emotion unleashed by the riot was staggering, a wave of rage and hatred that threatened to suck her into the mob. She readied a spell in one hand and clutched Frida with the other, trying to escape a very primal terror. Cold logic told her she had enough magic to protect herself, but it wasn't enough to make her feel safe. The crowd would rip her to pieces if it could lay hands on her.
"Stand aside," Sienna snapped.
Emily looked up. A dozen men charged towards their small group, faces twisted with fury. They all wore dark green tunics and caps, marking them out as devotees of the Horned God. Now, she braced herself, just as Sienna threw an overpowered force punch at the leader. A blast of magic picked him and his comrades up, tossing them through the air and slamming their helpless bodies into a nearby temple. They fell to the ground and lay still. It was easy, even at a distance, to tell that some of them were badly wounded, perhaps even dead.
"Keep moving."
Sienna glanced back at Emily.
"We have to get home, fast."
Emily swallowed, but did as she was told. Sienna was right. Emily just didn't like it. She braced herself as another group of Hands of Justice came around the corner, readying a spell, but the fanatics ignored them. They were more intent on slamming into the rioting worshippers and teaching them a lesson. The clubs they carried were less dangerous, she supposed, than swords, yet she knew hundreds of people were going to be hurt or killed. She shivered as the chant grew louder.
"Justice! Justice! Justice!"
The streets grew quieter as they hurried away from the temple. Dozens of guardsmen had materialized at one street corner, setting up barricades and turning away anyone who wanted to head to the temples. They looked terrified, a couple even sidling away as soon as they had the chance. Emily didn't blame them. There were enough rioters in the area to smash through their lines if they decided to rampage through the rest of the city. She wasn't sure there were enough trained guardsmen to put an end to the riot. "They'll have to use magic," she thought. A pair of black-clad sorcerers, wearing blue armbands, hurried up to join the guard. And who knows what that will do?
"General," a guardsman called, "is it true?"
General Pollock slowed.
"Is what true?" "Is he dead?"
the guard asked. Others looked up, hoping to hear the answer.
"Is Vesperian dead?"
"Say no," Emily urged silently. Rumors were already spreading, but if they were lucky, perhaps they could keep them from spreading too far. People wouldn't want to believe that Vesperian was dead. Don't pour fuel on the fire.
"Yes," General Pollock said. "I saw him die."
Emily cursed inwardly as they picked up speed again. Telling the guardsmen the truth had been a mistake. Even with the best will in the world, and that was lacking, Vesperian's death would cause economic shockwaves. Now, who knew how many people would run out of money while the council tried to figure out what to do, or how many others would seek redress through violence? A cold shiver ran down her spine. Beneficence was battening down the hatches, shopkeepers slamming their doors and sealing the windows while stallkeepers hurried away in all directions. A number of young men massed outside some of the shops, carrying all sorts of makeshift weapons. Emily couldn't tell if they intended to do some looting or prevent it. Perhaps they didn't know either. Their gazes flickered over the small group, then looked away. No doubt they'd recognize General Pollock or his wife. The noise dimmed slightly as they turned into Sorcerer's Row. A handful of sorcerers were hastily raising wards, casting charms over anyone who stepped through them. Sienna spoke briefly to the leader, who nodded shortly and motioned for the group to enter the street. Emily was surprised to note that the various magic users seemed to be working together surprisingly well. Normally, getting powerful sorcerers to cooperate was a little like herding cats. The prospect of a mass riot might just have concentrated a few minds, she thought. There were so many wards and defensive charms flickering through the air that she suspected some of them were interfering with the others. It was not going to be a peaceful night, and they might have decided to put old grudges aside to defend their homes. She turned, peering back towards Temple Row. A cloud of smoke rose into the air. Beneficence had a working fire service, but she doubted the firemen could get to the fire while the mob raged. The flames might not be a major problem on Temple Row. The temples were all built of stone, yet if the fire spread further, it would turn into a disaster. Most of the homes in Fishing Place were built of wood. The poorest and most helpless citizens would find themselves without a roof over their heads. "Get inside," Sienna snapped. Emily could feel the wards cracking through the air. "Now!" She hurried into the house. Sienna slammed the door. A moment later, the wards crashed down too. Emily tested them briefly. They were simple but tough, linked directly to Sienna's mind. Breaking them would be a complex task, one almost certainly beyond her. No one could enter or leave the house without Sienna's permission. "The coffin," Karen said. "We left it behind." "They won't touch it," Sienna said shortly. "I saw to that." You charmed an empty coffin. She wondered just what Sienna thought was inside the coffin, and yet it wasn't a question she dared ask. You went to a lot of effort. Why? A pale-faced girl appeared in the doorway. Emily started, then caught herself. The newcomer must be the maid. She looked to be around the same age as Karen, but she was so thin and pale that Emily couldn't help wondering what she ate. Her dark hair framed a pale face that was vaguely oriental in shape. "Mistress," she said, "what happened?" "A riot," Sienna said shortly. "Fetch drinks for us now." The maid curtsied, then retreated. Emily shivered helplessly as she followed the others into the living room. She would never grow used to servants. Never. There was something creepy about having someone to serve her, someone who had to do as they were told. Void had urged her to hire a maid, to have someone tend to her house during her absences, but she would be damned if she was enslaving anyone. Sure, her own thoughts mocked her. And how would you know your secrets were safe if you didn't?
I was going to meet a couple of friends, Croce said. You will be staying here, General Pollock said firmly. Riots are dangerous, even for young sorcerers.
Croce looked as if he were about to argue, but said nothing. Emily studied him for a long moment, then turned her head. Caleb sat on the sofa, looking tired. His hands shook slightly, a legacy of a nasty alchemical accident. Emily didn't blame him. He had drunk too much, even before all hell had broken loose. The maid returned, carrying a tray of mugs. Emily took the offered drink, then tried to shoot the young girl a smile. The maid looked shocked just for a moment. She handed out the rest of the mugs and departed as fast as possible. Emily felt a stab of sympathy as she sipped her cava. Working for Sienna had to be a difficult task.
I saw justice.
Marion looked up defiantly.
He was on top of the tower.
I very much doubt it, Sienna said sharply. Be silent.
I saw him, Marion insisted. Mother, Vesperian jumped to avoid being petrified.
Sienna gave her youngest daughter a quelling look.
You will be quiet.
Emily thought fast. Something had been up there, but what? She definitely sensed something. And every spell she'd cast to stop Vesperian's fall had failed, the magic breaking up and fading out of existence. She'd seen protective wards that worked like that. They were among the first she'd learned to cast, but she'd never seen one that had deflected so many spells. Whoever had cast the ward, if it was a ward, had been a powerful magician. Or they could have configured the spell to feed off the unleashed magic, she mused. It wouldn't last indefinitely, but it might hold out longer.
She tossed the equations round and round in her head. The real downside was that the ward wouldn't discriminate. It would happily absorb both incoming and outgoing spells. But if someone didn't have magic, and she hadn't seen proof that Vesperian had magic, it wouldn't matter. They wouldn't be doing anything the ward might block. Marion came to her feet.
I saw him!
No, you didn't, Sienna said. You don't know what was up there, nor do I.
Justice, Marion insisted. Mother, I...
Sienna rose.
Go to your room, she ordered, in a tone that suggested further arguing was pointless. I will be up shortly.
Marion glared at her, then rose and stamped through the door. Emily could hear her crashing her way up the stairs and slamming her bedroom door. She felt a moment of pity for the younger girl, mingled with contempt. Sienna was right. There was no real proof that a god was walking the streets. Whoever had killed the original set of victims might finally have caught up with Vesperian himself.
Emily, Karen said into the chilly silence, what will happen now he's dead?
Emily shook her head. She'd had a quick look through the law books, but Beneficence didn't have anything resembling a modern regulatory framework. A person could go bankrupt. A family could go bankrupt. There hadn't been any large corporations until the new learning. Certainly nothing as large as Vesperian's business. The largest institutions she knew had been trading firms, and few of them had operated more than a handful of ships.
I don't know, she said. This has never happened before.
Not here, Caleb said.
Emily nodded shortly. I suppose it depends on what happens to the estate.
The notes had been due tomorrow, if she recalled correctly. Vesperian's estate probably wouldn't be paying out on them, not immediately. There would be hundreds, perhaps thousands of people watching their life savings evaporate. It will take weeks to figure out just how much he owes. Sienna peered at her narrowly.
You've seen it happen before.
Only in theory, Emily said.
It wasn't entirely true. She'd been on Earth when the dot-com bubble burst, yet she hadn't really taken notice. The crash hadn't made her life any better or worse. We discussed the possibility in Zangaria.
Sienna didn't look convinced.
Emily winced inwardly. She didn't want to tell Sienna the truth. Not yet. Perhaps not ever. Who knew what Sienna would do if she learned alternate worlds and dimensions existed? And yet Caleb's mother had probably figured out there was something odd about her prospective daughter-in-law. She would certainly want answers sooner or later.
Karen coughed. And what did you conclude?
That we should be careful, Emily said.
I don't know what we can do.
The council may push for a moratorium on payouts, General Pollock said. If Vesperian had no reason to expect his death, he might not have updated his will.
He certainly should have, Sienna said. Death can come at any time.
She rose.
Emily, Frida, I suggest you have a rest, she said, as she headed for the door. I don't think anyone will be foolish enough to try to break through the wards, but you never know. Don't try to leave the house.
We won't, Emily said.
I'll be in my office, General Pollock said. Don't hesitate to call if you need anything.
Caleb followed Emily and Frida up the stairs, then jabbed a meaningful finger at their bedroom door. Frida hesitated, glancing towards Marion's door before opening her door and hurrying through. Caleb reached out and hugged Emily the moment the door was half closed, holding her tightly. His hands were still shaking.
I'm sorry I wasn't with you during the ceremony, he said. I...
He shook his head. Emily wondered again just how much he'd had to drink. She'd seen Caleb angry, but not maudlin. And yet, Casper had been maudlin when he'd been drinking alone. She hadn't liked seeing that, either.
It wasn't your fault, she said.
Caleb hadn't designed the ceremony. The rules had been laid down hundreds of years ago. Men and women were separated as soon as they entered the temple. Hell, she'd had the impression that women were rarely allowed to visit.
I'm sorry the service was ruined.
Casper is probably looking down on us now and laughing, Caleb said. His funeral turned into a riot. He'd find that amusing.
He shook his head.
I hope he's happy, wherever he is.
Me too, Emily said.
And everyone asked me when I was going to get married, Caleb added. They all seemed to want to know.
That's because you are now the heir, Sienna said. Emily jumped. Sienna stood in Marion's doorway, holding a wooden hairbrush in one hand.
I believe I explained that earlier. Caleb took a step backwards. Why do they care? Because they have to know what's going to happen in the next few years.
She cocked her head thoughtfully.
If there's a city left, that is.
There will be, Caleb said.
Perhaps, Sienna agreed. We shall see.
Her voice hardened.
Go to bed, she ordered, and make sure you take a sober-up potion before you close your eyes.
Yes, mother, Caleb said.
And remember what else I told you, Sienna added. Not under my roof.
Emily flushed. They hadn't been doing anything apart from hugging, but she knew Sienna was in a dark mood. The funeral had been ruined. Casper might be laughing, as Caleb had suggested, but his parents had to be furious. They might need to hold the ceremony again.
Sleep, Sienna ordered, and behave.
Emily stepped into her room and closed the door. Chapter 16.
That was careless,
Frida said, as Emily shut the door. Her tone was light, but her eyes were serious.
You could have been in real trouble.
Emily shrugged, locking the door and pulling off her robe. She'd faced necromancers and a whole host of other monsters. Sienna was intimidating, but not that scary. Her nightgown was where she'd left it. She pulled it over her undershirt, then lay down on the bed. The wards were a reassuring presence at the back of her mind, but she knew sleep wouldn't come easy. It felt like hours before she fell into darkness.
It's breakfast, Frida said. Did you sleep well?
You're joking,
Emily said in shock. She glanced at her watch. Frida wasn't joking. She'd slept for over 10 hours. Odd, when she'd barely drawn on her magic.
Maybe she'd accidentally charmed herself to sleep.
She hoped not. There were stories about young magicians who'd done just that and wound up trapped in their own minds. None of them ended well. She pulled herself out of bed, splashed some water on her face, and pulled on another blue dress. Trousers would be better if she had to run, but she had none. Maybe she could borrow a pair from Karen.
I hope you slept, she said, as they opened the door. Did you? For a while, Frida said. And then I studied instead.
They walked down the stairs. It was dark outside, the sun barely glimmering below the horizon. There was no sign of Caleb, Croce, or Marion at the breakfast table. General Pollock, Sienna, and Karen sat there, eating lumpy bowls of porridge. It dawned on Emily, as Sienna pointed to a chair, that starvation was a real possibility. If they couldn't get out of the house...
The riot seemed to have simmered down, General Pollock said, by way of greeting.
Emily would have been more impressed if he wasn't still wearing his sword.
There was no trouble up here.
They went looking for easier targets, Sienna said, as Karen served Emily and Frida. I don't think many rioters would be stupid enough to challenge the wards.
Emily hoped Sienna was right, but she doubted it. Rioters weren't even as clever as the stupidest person in the mob. It was easy to imagine crowds pushing against the wards, forced into contact by their fellows. Pain wouldn't stop them when the pushers weren't the ones being hurt. But then, the sorcerers should be able to make their wards strong enough to keep the crowds out without seriously hurting anyone. She chewed her porridge carefully. It was strikingly bland, without sugar, milk, or anything else that might make it more edible. She told herself firmly that she should be glad to have it. There were people on the streets who might be starving by now. God alone knew what had happened outside the wards. Karen took the bowl as soon as Emily had finished and carried it back into the kitchen. Emily suspected Karen was looking for something to do to keep herself occupied. Sienna cocked her head.
We've got visitors, she said. Come into the living room.
Emily tensed as she rose. Hostile visitors? But Sienna didn't look alarmed. She watched as Sienna parted the wards and opened the front door. Two men stood there, one wearing a long red robe, the other a blue uniform with a silver star on the collar. A guardsman, she guessed. The robed man looked to have had too much comfortable living. He was strikingly pudgy, with a long white beard that fell to his chest, but his companion reminded her of General Pollock. His scars told her that the guardsman had been through too much to let himself run to fat.
"Guildmaster Jaleel," Sienna said, "and Captain Haverford."
"It is always a pleasure, Mediator," Jaleel said.
His voice was so perfectly aristocratic that he would have fit in at King Randor's court.
And Lady Emily, I believe. It is a pleasure to meet you at last.
Guildmaster Jaleel is the current Grand Guildmaster, Sienna said, as she led the two men into the living room. Emily frowned. She was fairly sure that Jaleel had been one of the people who'd sent her letters. Captain Haverford is the current head of the City Guard.
That I am.
Haverford had a curt way of speaking that reminded her of Sergeant Harkin. Emily was fairly sure that Haverford was not a man to play politics.
And time is not on our side.
Sienna nodded. Your bodyguards will get impatient, she agreed. You have a small army waiting outside.
The streets are not safe, Haverford said. The guard is overwhelmed.
Jaleel cleared his throat, looking directly at Sienna.
As the Grand Guild Master, I am formally requesting your assistance with the investigation.
Sienna lifted her eyebrows.
Mine? Your word is good, Mediator, Jaleel said. We need to know what happened to Vesperian now. Did he commit suicide? Did he fall off the building by accident, or was he pushed?
There was something up there, Emily thought. But what?
An understandable request, Sienna said. I will require the usual compensatory package, as well as a warrant from the Council to question witnesses and go wherever I deem necessary.
Jaleel reached into his robes and produced a piece of old-style parchment.
I took the liberty of convincing the Council to sign, he said, holding it out to Sienna. They are desperate for answers.
Then I will be off presently, Sienna said. She glanced at Emily.
I will be taking Lady Emily with me, of course.
Emily stared at her.
Me?
Jaleel showed no visible reaction at all.
If you are willing to assume responsibility for her, then I dare say we can offer no objection. But please be careful.
Of course, Sienna said.
And we would also like the services of your husband, Haverford added. The city guard is being reinforced. It will be my pleasure to serve, General Pollock said. Then we will take our leave.
Jaleel rose ponderously and bowed.
I look forward to your report.
Emily stared after them until they'd left the house. You're taking me along.
Everyone knows you have an odd sense for magic, Sienna said. And besides, I don't want to leave you and Caleb alone.
She ignored Emily's flush.
Get your cloak. We'll be leaving in 10 minutes.
Emily swallowed the angry response that came to mind. She wasn't Sienna's daughter-in-law. Not yet. Sienna couldn't order her around as if she were a servant. And yet, she was curious. Jaleel was right. They did need to know what had happened to Vesperian as soon as possible. She hurried back to the kitchen, told Frida what had happened, and went to grab her coat. It would be chilly outside. The streets were surprisingly clear, even after they passed through the wards, but there were signs of damage all around. She saw watching eyes peering from upper windows as they walked down the street, past damaged storefronts and a handful of dead bodies lying in the gutter. Small squads of city guardsmen marched from place to place, carrying their clubs as if they expected an attack at any moment. Perhaps they were right, Emily thought. She was sure one of the bodies had been wearing a guardsman's uniform. Temple Row was a mess, she saw, as they turned the corner. Hundreds of statues had been damaged or destroyed, while several temples had been desecrated. Priests and their devotees tried to clean up the mess, watched by patrolling guardsmen. A small pile of bodies, some hacked to pieces, had been dumped at the edge of the street. She hoped someone removed the bodies before they started to decay. Beneficence had enough problems without a disease outbreak. The Temple of War was a shadow of its former self. The stone walls still stood, but the interior had been thoroughly devastated. Sienna let out a grunt of pain as they approached the coffin, then a sigh of relief as she checked the wards. The coffin remained intact, thankfully. Emily wanted to say something, anything, as Sienna paused, but nothing came to mind. Eventually, Caleb's mother led her out into the back garden. Vesperian's body still lay on the ground.
It's definitely him.
Sienna paced around the body, muttering to herself.
His fall must have been slowed a little. The face is remarkably intact for someone who fell 10 stories and landed hard.
Emily glanced at Sienna with respect. She hadn't thought of that. Sienna looked up.
He fell from the Temple of Stone, she added thoughtfully. How did he even get to the roof?
The temple was deserted, they discovered. Sienna pulled a wand from her belt and waved it around, then stepped back in puzzlement. The wards that should have been in place